TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
How the demonstrations in Turkey and the U.S. bombing of Yemen affect the fate of Gaza, and will Iran be next? Mohammed Mawandi from the University of Tehran gives a close-up portrait of the countries surrounding Israel-Palestine. Mawandi was interviewed by Nima on the podcast channel Dialogue Works. They spoke on Monday, March 24, 2025. The bombing of Yemen that the U.S. Trump administration had launched was continuing as they spoke. Analysts describe it as one of the largest U.S. bombing attacks on Yemen in years. There also have been ongoing demonstrations in the streets of Istanbul, Turkey. Hundreds of thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators show support for the city's jailed mayor. He's seen as the main rival to President Erdogan in the upcoming elections. Nima's guest, Mohammed Mawandi, is an Iranian-American academic and political analyst. He's currently a professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran. Mawandi has appeared as a political and social commentator on international news networks, and he's an advisor to the Iranian nuclear negotiations team in Vienna. Here's Nima with his first question.
Do you think that the situation in Turkey would bring some sort of complication in the situation in Gaza? What is happening on the ground in Turkey in terms of new sort of protests in Turkey?
I don't think it has any impact on Gaza because Erdogan has never helped the Palestinian people. He has not sent weapons to Gaza. He's doing business with Netanyahu. He continues to sell transport oil throughout the genocide. Turkish Airways continues to fly to Tel Aviv, even though Ansarullah has warned all foreign airlines to stop flights to and from the regime. But Turkey does the exact opposite. So what is happening in Turkey has no positive or negative impact on Gaza. It may have an impact on Syria, because I'm sure the terrorist groups are worried about what's happening in Ankara and Istanbul and elsewhere. But I think what is happening in Turkey weakens Turkey significantly. I don't expect Erdogan to be removed from power, for these people to carry out some sort of revolution. That's just not possible. But I think it weakens Turkey a lot. It will weaken the Turkish economy. But on the other hand, his rival, he has spoken negatively about the resistance in Gaza. So those who are cheering on President Erdogan's adversary, his chief adversary, should be careful for what they wish for.
When it comes to Erdogan and his support for Wahhabis, for ISIS, does he really care about the opinion of Iran and Russia on these groups, and which are of a huge concern for Russia and Iran?
There's always been this debate about Mr. Erdogan in Iran. Some say he's a great politician because he's always playing one side against another. But others, and I tend to agree with the second group, say that he is seen as not having any principles because he will do an agreement with you and then he will betray you and do an agreement with the other side. Then he'll betray the other side and do an agreement with you. And in the short term, that has advantages. But in the long term, it is both unprincipled, but it creates an environment where no one trusts you. And right now, Mr. Erdogan, I think, is someone who no one trusts. There are many examples. If you recall, when he sent the Ukrainian POWs back to Ukraine, these Azov neo-Nazi prisoners that the Russians gave to Turkey, without Russian permission, he sent them to Ukraine. That's just a small example. It's basically how he works. At times, he has shown a great deal of friendship with Iran and with Russia, and at times he's tilted away from both of them or one of them he shifts and changes, and that makes him an unreliable partner. In Syria, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the Iranians and the Russians agreed with Erdogan to allow these terrorists to stay in Idlib. Why? Because Erdogan was worried about the implications of them being pushed into Turkey and Turkish stability. And so the Iranians and the Russians agreed that they would stay there so that it would not cause any internal problems for Turkey. They agreed. But what did Erdogan do? He used that as a foothold. He retrained and regrouped these people and brought in thousands more foreign fighters from China, from Uzbekistan, from Tajikistan, from across Central Asia, from Russia, and he deployed them to take over Syria. Of course, he didn't expect Syria to fall, but he, in any case, he wanted to expand the rule of ISIS and Al-Qaeda in northern Syria so that he could negotiate with a stronger hand with the Syrian government. But the Syrian government collapsed and everything changed.
It seems that the war in Yemen and the way that Trump was fighting Yemenis in the Red Sea is because of putting pressure on Iran again. Is that related to what's going on between Iran and the United States?
Well, you know, you actually raise it an interesting point. We see that everything is, the focus is on weakening Iran. But I agree. I think that the war in Yemen or the genocidal attacks on Yemen have probably three purposes. One is to make the United States look strong, and that's how America works. And presidents in the United States get popular when they bomb countries. That is one of the, you know, sickening things about American society today. Of course, it's the mass media, the corporate media, or the legacy media, that mainstream media that pushes this narrative. But in any case, leaders in the United States become popular when they attack countries, when they bomb countries. Even Trump, during the height of the anti-Russia sentiments in the United States being promoted by the Democrats and his opposition and Russiagate, when he bombed Syria, suddenly the mainstream media supported him. Until then, he was illegitimate and a foreign agent, and then they were rooting for him all overnight because he was, you know, firing missiles at Damascus and other cities. That's sadly how it is. So in the case of Yemen, I think part of it is to look strong, especially since Trump is going to have to give huge concessions to Russia to achieve any sort of peace agreement. So I think that is a distraction. Second is to help the Israeli regime, because the siege in the Red Sea is costly. Ansar Allah is blocking the Red Sea to ships destined to Israeli regime ports, and because they blocked food inside Gaza. And this was before the genocide began again. So they're trying to help the Americans. What the Americans are doing is that they're bombing Yemen so that Israel could more easily carry out genocide. That's basically it. And the third reason is to sort of like sending a message to Iran that we're bombing Yemen and look, you know, you're next, or you're potentially next. But the point is that, or the issue is that the United States has failed so far in Yemen. And it's not as if Biden didn't try. Biden regularly bombed the country. He regularly carried out airstrikes and slaughtered people across the country. And it's very costly for the United States. They have to bring ships, each of those aircraft carriers and other ships, it's very costly for them to be there. The planes, when they fly to bomb the people of Yemen, it's very costly, these airstrikes, especially since the aircraft carrier has to move far away from Yemen to protect itself. And every time Yemen strikes back with drones and missiles that are very inexpensive, high-tech but inexpensive, the Americans have to use very expensive missiles to defend themselves. So this is going to be very costly. And ultimately, the Americans are going to fail. So instead of sending a message that frightens Iran, what it's doing is it's sending a message that the Americans thought they can do something, but they're miscalculating, and they have miscalculated.
Does Yemen have indigenous capabilities of producing their arms?
Yes, Yemen is a very sophisticated society. It is maybe the oldest civilization on this planet. They are very smart people. They have universities. They have very innovative people. And they had a military industry before all this began. And I'm sure that the Iranians are assisting them, which they should. And the Iranians do not hide it. But it's not as if it's all the Iranians. It's just, you know, Iranian assistance. These people have huge capabilities. This is a government. The government of Yemen, which controls the capital, is running a country. And part of their responsibility, or one of their responsibilities, is to develop an indigenous defense capability, because we saw the Saudis and the Emiratis with Western support carry out a 7-year genocidal war. And then we saw the Americans constantly bomb Yemen when Yemen tried to stop the genocide in Gaza.
And how about the Arab League? They ask all of the countries who have economic ties with Israel should just put an end to those sort of ties. But are they really honest the way they're asking for this sort of attitude?
None of the countries that have had ties with the Israeli regimes have done anything about those ties. Turkey is its business with Israel. I mean, they have direct flights. How bad can it get? How awful could Mr. Erdogan be when it comes to Palestine? If Turkey alone, if the government in Turkey decided to break off ties with Israel, alongside what the resistance is doing, would be a severe blow to the regime. Just Turkey alone. But he refuses to do that. Egypt, business as usual. Jordan, business as usual. The Emirates, more than business as usual. And Saudi Arabia, it allows its territory to be used by Jordan to do trade with the Israeli regime. And of course, now we see a regime has come into power in Syria, which has allowed the Israelis to occupy huge amounts of its territory. And the regime is not at all interested in supporting the Palestinian cause. So there's nothing serious going on in the Arab world when it comes to, among the rulers, when it comes to defending the Palestinian people. That could change. That could change. And this is something that I firmly believe. What the Israeli regime is doing by restarting this genocide is only putting more pressure on these regimes. It's making them look less legitimate. Let me give you the example of Mr. Erdogan. If Erdogan was sincere in his support for the Palestinian people, and he doesn't have to make sacrifices like the Iranians to be sanctioned, to be attacked, all he has to do is cut off all ties with the Israeli regime. The economic damage that it would do to Turkey would be not that big, but his popularity would have strengthened significantly, not only at home, but also abroad. And I think that he would have been under, his position would have been different today with regards to protests. I mean, his opponents, I know that they have always despised him, but a segment of his supporters have left him. And that is because they see him as unprincipled. So, you know, I think he's harmed himself also politically by not breaking off ties with the Israeli regime. But he's in a less threatened, he's under less pressure, and he's threatened less than Jordan. The regime in Jordan is despised. People know what's going on. They know that the regime is complicit, or Egypt and elsewhere. Ultimately, that could lead to consequences. We've already seen Mubarak fall in Egypt less than 2 decades ago. It's not something that's impossible to imagine happening again and elsewhere as well.
What's happening, and many people do not know about the nature of the support coming from Iran and Yemen to Gaza, that people in Iran and in Yemen mostly are Shia Muslim, and the people in Gaza are mostly Sunni Muslim. And when we look at the Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain is mostly Shia, by the way, these countries were mostly Sunni, and do you think that they're feeling much pressure from the public opinion? Are they going to face huge protests in their country?
Well, we have to also remember that the Republic of Azerbaijan is a Shia country, but the dictatorship there is selling inexpensive oil to Israel. They are allies, and they've just signed an agreement to develop new gas fields and to in the Mediterranean together. And there's a lot of discontent in the Republic of Azerbaijan because of this. And I think the same is true elsewhere. I mean, what the Americans have done over the past 40-some years is that they've used oil and gas-rich regimes in the Persian Gulf region in particular to create sectarian and racist racial hostility. We saw that a lot during the war when Saddam invaded Iran. The media was spreading chauvinism against non-Arabs and Iranians in particular. Then increasingly we saw Wahhabism and Salafism being promoted by many. There are, you know, hundreds of television channels, and we saw that in particular in 2011 and 12 being spread by all of these countries against Shias, and it was extraordinary disinformation and hatred and hostility, something that you'd have to go back to the 1950s in the United States and, you know, read Ku Klux Klan material to see the parallels, and trying to create hatred among Sunnis towards Shias, and at the same time trying to make Salafism and Wahhabism takfiri, especially the violent takfiri variant, mainstream, which wasn't the case. This is the policy of divide and rule. The United States and its regional client regimes, they have a lot of money and they will use it. And so you do see some people influenced by this, and some people have now so much hatred that it's difficult to change them. And there's a lot of people who have a vested interest. There's a lot of money involved in sectarianism, especially now that things are not going well for the United States and Israel. So, you know, divide and rule especially as the empire grows weaker, I think it's a tool that they'll be needing more than ever before. But a lot has changed. The fact that Hezbollah, which is Shia, the fact that Ansarullah, which is Zaydi, you know, it is Shia, but a different Shia group, they're the ones who've sacrificed the most for Palestine, I think has had a huge impact. The fact that these rebels in Syria, these moderate rebels in Syria, have turned out to be such, you know, horrific killers, I think has woken up people across the world. The mood towards the understanding of what's happening in Syria today is very different from 2012, 13, 14, 15, or 16 and 17. Back then, they were just a very small group of people who are trying to create awareness about the fact that these groups that the West is supporting, they're ISIS, they're Al-Qaeda, they are extremists, they're tools in the hands of NATO. Now you see that this has become something that critics of U.S. foreign policy have widely acknowledged. You even see that U.S. officials like Tulsi Gabbard, although she's changed a lot over the past few weeks, her position on Yemen has changed, her position changing very rapidly. But in any case, in the Senate confirmation hearings, she admitted basically what we were saying all along, that the United States was supporting Al-Qaeda, that they were funding Al-Qaeda. So it's not good for the Israeli regime right now. There's a much better appreciation of Hezbollah and the extraordinary role that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah had played for the Palestinian people and what Ansarullah is doing. And that brings nations together. And so I think the United States and its clients will redouble their efforts to intensify sectarian hatred and racial hatred.
Getting back to Iranian nuclear program and the talks between the United States and Iran, the foreign minister of Iran, Abbas Araghchi, he said in his latest interview, he said that the reality of Iranian nuclear program has changed drastically. And the nature of the way that Donald Trump and his administration are force in Iranian has changed as well. Is that going to complicate the situation between Iran and the United States? Is that going to force them to negotiate?
I think that Iran has a much stronger hand today than it did back then. Iran's nuclear program is much more developed, thanks to Trump. Thanks to Trump, because of Trump, Iran halted its commitments to the nuclear deal. Again, Iran is fully committed to the NPT, and it abides by the legal framework that exists with, you know, within the International Atomic Energy Agency. But the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, limited Iran's nuclear industry. So since Trump tore up the deal, Iran developed its nuclear industry. And so now Iran is one of the most advanced countries in the world when it comes to nuclear energy. It is probably in the top 10. And this is something that Trump will have to accept. Can't just say you have to give it up. That's never going to happen. We're not going to go back to 2015 anymore. Because this is not the same nuclear program, as Dr. Araghchi rightly pointed out. The second is that Iran's missile and drone capabilities are infinitely different from in the past. Iran's military capabilities are far greater than what they were. Iran has chosen a very smart route to make a strong, inexpensive, relatively speaking, high-tech military industry, which can defend the country. And I think based on American and Western claims, we've seen that impact in Russia. We've seen, according to the Americans, that Iran drone capabilities, they're having a daily effect. So Iran's military is different today. And the United States is in a much tougher situation because of the global challenges with, you know, Russia and China, the major problems that they face at home. So there is always a potential for a deal. But at the moment, because of the attitude of the United States, the Iranians have no interest in negotiating. If the United States changes its attitude and shows that it can be trusted at some point down the road, the Americans are going to have to take all of these into consideration. Trump was the person who weakened his own hand, partially at least, when it comes to the nuclear program itself.
Part of what Witkoff said in his interview was that the other option would be attacking Iran. What would be the response on the part of Iran?
Well, let's just look at the map, the Persian Gulf. Iran owns half of the Persian Gulf. That's why it's called the Persian Gulf, and the northern side. And it's not a very wide piece of water. It's thin and long. And look at where U.S. bases are, Qatar, in the Emirates, in Bahrain, in Kuwait. Well, if the United States attacks Iran, these tiny countries are all complicit. What does that mean for their future existence? I mean, if there's a war, and then their infrastructure is fair game. They can't. If the Americans attack Iranian infrastructure or military targets, that's war. And so these regimes won't last more than a few hours or a few days. And you would see chaos across the Persian Gulf region. And then there would be no more tankers. The tankers would all be at the bottom of the Persian Gulf. So no more oil, no more gas. And I'm sure in Iraq you will see the resistance preventing oil and gas getting to the West. Probably in the Republic of Azerbaijan you would see similar moves of people outraged. That would create a global economic catastrophe that I think is historically unprecedented. And it's not something that the Americans can do anything about. I mean, look at Yemen. It's clear that Yemen's military capabilities are very small compared to Iran's military capabilities. I mean, the people of Yemen are heroic, they are brave, they are courageous, and they are the heroes alongside Hezbollah. They and Hezbollah sacrifice themselves for another people. That's unbelievable, you know, what they've done and what they're doing. But Iran's military capabilities are second to none in the region, and the region is very, very sensitive because of oil and gas and because of the petrochemical plants and because of the refineries and because of all the ships and because of all the trade and also because of all the desalination plants and all that. It's very vulnerable situation. These are all glass palaces. These are all glass mansions. War in this region would destroy the U.S. economy. And then imagine people on the move from center, because the world economy will collapse. Imagine people on the move everywhere. And where will they probably go, even though the United States and Europe will collapse? They'll be going to the United States and Europe. The amount of people going now would be just a trickle compared to the what we'll see if the global economy collapses. So I don't think that the United States wants this. I don't think that the military wants this. Of course, Netanyahu would love this. Fanatical Zionist ethno-supremacist madmen want this. But I don't think at the moment the U.S. military would allow such a thing to happen. Nothing is for certain. Trump is definitely not a very, how should I put it, stable person. He may wake up in the morning and then suddenly say something different from what he was saying the night before. But I think that the stakes are simply too high for now.
Is there any room left for Russia and China participating, somehow trying to negotiate between Iran and the United States, and most importantly, for the situation in Gaza, for the situation for Palestinians?
When countries in the region refuse to sanction the Israeli regime, when they refuse to break off ties with the regime, when Erdogan is refusing to end trade and business with the regime, where he refuses to stop flights to Ben-Gurion Airport, how can we expect China and Russia to make big steps in the right direction? If these regimes did take steps, then that would create an environment where other countries would do the same. But so far, none have done it. None of them have made a move.
That was Mohammad Mirvandi, an Iranian-American academic and political analyst. He's currently a professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran. He was interviewed by Nima on the podcast channel Dialogue Works. Nima is assistant professor of civil engineering at the Federal University of Itajuba in Brazil. They spoke on Monday, March 24, 2025. My thanks to Dialogue Works, where the full 104-minute long conversation is posted under the title Mohammad Mirvandi, Yemen's Hypersonic Strike on Tel Aviv. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.